And the bottom line is ultimately it threatens access to health care for many, many Alaskans.
The state Senate's capital budget could fund two controversial infrastructure projects, but skimps on Medicaid. From Alaska Public Media, this is statewide news on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, May 9th. Good evening. I'm Zachariah Hughes. Also tonight, the U.S. Senate holds a confirmation hearing for Tara Sweeney to become Assistant Secretary of Indian Affairs.
You have a room full of Inupiat Eskimos, and so I appreciate the staff keeping this room nice and cool.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com.
The Alaska Senate passed a capital budget that seeks to revive the Kinnick Arm Bridge and the Juneau Access Project, but it doesn't include Medicaid funding that state officials say is needed by next week to pay health care providers. Wasilla Republican Senator David Wilson sponsored the amendment to spend $4.5 million on the Kinnick Arm Bridge. He says the bridge would provide relief to the Glenn Highway.
We have not done any major road infrastructure projects to our great state in over 40 years.
Governor Bill Walker shut down the work on both the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Juneau Road. The mega projects are unlikely to move forward under Walker, but if the House agrees to the funding, they could be revived in the future. The capital budget does not include $48 million for Medicaid. Hospitals say the funding is critical. Anchorage Democratic Senator Berta Gardner says failing to adequately fund Medicaid is a mistake.
You know, it threatens hospitals. It threatens care providers' willingness to participate in the Medicaid program. And the bottom line is ultimately it threatens access to health care for many, many Alaskans.
If the capital budget doesn't provide the Medicaid money, state payments to providers would be delayed until July. That could present problems to smaller providers, which may not have enough cash to pay their bills. More than a quarter of Alaskans receive Medicaid. The total for the state capital budget is nearly $300 million less than Walker proposed, but much of Walker's proposal would have been funded by a tax on income that lawmakers rejected. The Senate passed the bill by a 15-4 vote on Tuesday. The House Finance Committee was scheduled to discuss the capital budget late today. If the House makes changes, the two chambers would have to work out their differences before sending the capital budget to Walker's desk. The Walker administration is asking for public input as it develops a sweeping new climate policy for the state. The governor's climate change task force has released an updated draft of the policy. It's asking the public to weigh in online by June 4th. The draft proposes a series of targets to shrink the state's carbon footprint by 2025. Those include cutting greenhouse gas emissions by about a third from 2005 levels and generating half the state's electricity from renewable sources. The draft proposes Alaska invest in the state's clean energy economy and promote natural gas as a potential bridge fuel. But it emphasizes that the state remains dependent on oil production, and it suggests using oil revenue to fund a strategic transition to renewable energy and a more diversified economy. The draft also recommends the state play a more active role in helping local communities adapt to climate change. That includes planning for threats like coastal erosion, severe flooding, and reduced access to subsistence foods. Perhaps most controversially, the draft says the state should consider a version of a carbon tax to encourage the switch away from fossil fuels. Walker established the 20-person climate team this past winter. The task force includes representatives from environmental groups, local communities, the university system, commercial fishing, mining, and the oil industry. The team is required to recommend a full statewide climate policy and action plan to the governor by September. The state of Alaska held a lease sale for offshore acreage in Cook Inlet today with modest results. The state offered 2.6 million acres, but just one company, Hilcorp, bid on about 17,000 acres. Hilcorp is currently the biggest oil and gas producer in Cook Inlet. The Texas-based company will pay close to $300,000 for the additional acreage it picked up at the sale. Kyle Smith is the leasing section chief with the Alaska Department of Natural Resources.
We'd always like to see a larger lease sale and more money come into the state. With the Cook Inlet, the gas demand has mostly been met through 2023, 2024 through existing gas contracts, and the incentives aren't quite what they were years ago.
Faced with dwindling funds, the legislature phased out tax credits for oil and gas companies in Cook Inlet over the past 2 years. Smith adds the sale shows most companies in Cook Inlet are investing in producing from areas they've already leased rather than exploring new areas. Alaskan Tara McLean Sweeney faced no resistance at a U.S. Senate confirmation hearing today on her nomination to be Assistant Interior Secretary for Indian Affairs. Sweeney is now an executive vice president at Arctic Slope Regional Corporation. She would be the first Alaska Native woman to hold the federal position, which oversees the Bureau of Indian Affairs and helps manage federal relations with Native American tribes. Sweeney brought her family and lots of Arctic Slope leaders to the Senate Indian Affairs hearing.
You have a room full of Inupiat Eskimos, and so I appreciate the staff keeping this room nice and cool, because it is very warm for the rest of us.
Outside, the temperature was approaching 80 degrees.
I can tell you this Eskimo is melting.
One of Sweeney's guests was ASRC founding director Oliver Levitt, who she says inspired her career choice when she was 12. She recalls Levitt came to her school in Barrow to talk about the opportunities of the new Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, the law that created ASRC and the other Alaska Native regional corporations.
As he left the building, I looked over to my friends, and including his son, and said, I want to work there. I want to work for him. I want to do what he is doing for our people.
Several senators, including Senator Lisa Murkowski, told Sweeney they want her to be tough and make demands within the administration to solve problems of Native people, like high rates of domestic violence, substance abuse, and unemployment.
We need you busting down doors and saying, we have to talk.
President Trump picked Sweeney for the job in October, but the Office of Government Ethics in the executive branch held up the process out of concern over her shares in Alaska Native corporations, including ASRC. Sweeney says the ethics pledge she signed commits her to stay out of all matters involving ASRC. Democratic Senator Tom Udall pressed her further.
And will you recuse yourself from any matter that may benefit ASRC, including oil and gas development in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge?
My ethics pledge requires me to recuse myself from all matters pertaining to ASRC, and I will adhere to that, yes.
Yeah. Thank you.
There's no word yet on when the Senate committee will move her confirmation to the full Senate for a vote. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a lower 48 hiker prepares to traverse the Brooks Range to raise awareness of LGBT causes.
There are not a lot of queer people in the outdoors, so visibility around that feels really good to me, and I'm super stoked about it.
That is ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Matson, committed to the communities it serves, building on more than 50 years of service to the communities of Alaska. Learn more at Matson.com. And by Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute, committing to improving the lives of Alaskans. Using a team approach, Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute offers a range of cardiovascular diagnoses and care. Learn more at AlaskaHeart.com.
A spring count shows a slight increase in the number of wolves in Denali National Park.
Last year was at 72 animals, and this year is at 76.
Park Science and Resources team leader Dave Schirokauer says the aerial count is still well below average, but continues to rebound from a record low of 49 wolves in 2016. The state estimated last month that up to 8 park wolves were trapped or shot outside Denali's northeast boundary this past winter. Schirokauer says the take included the alpha male of the Riley Creek Pack, a wolf family group which was commonly seen last summer by visitors along the nearby park road. Biologist and wildlife advocate Rick Steiner of Anchorage suspects the Riley Creek Pack will disperse, diminishing the chances of seeing them along the park road, a situation similar to what happened 3 years ago to the once commonly viewed East Fork Pack.
The alpha female from East Fork was killed, and that led to the ultimate complete disintegration of the pack.
Steiner and other wildlife advocates have long pushed the state to ban wolf harvest outside the park's northeast boundary, where wolves who live near the park road often cross onto state land. The most recent pack in Denali's wolf population occurred between the most recent peak in Denali's wolf population occurred between 2006 and 2008, when the boundary between area was closed to wolf killing. The buffer was rescinded by the state game board in 2010. The small town of Wrangell is making a big ask for the soon-to-be-finalized state budget. The city and local tribe are asking for an additional $5 million to clean up tons of lead-contaminated soil. The only problem is the proposed dumping site is strongly opposed by the community, and the town is looking for any extra funds to ship the waste off the island and down to the lower 48. KSTK's June Leffler reports.
Governor Bill Walker went to bat for concerned citizens in Wrangell. He asked for millions of dollars to help ship 18,000 cubic yards of lead-contaminated soil off the island. And Monday, the Senate Finance Committee responded by allocating $2.5 million in its amended budget to the cleanup. Tuesday, the House Finance Committee heard plenty of testimony from Wrangell residents, asking them to add another $2.5 million. Angie Flickinger lives in Wrangell.
The $5 million in the capital budget for this project would allow for a state and city to ship the remaining hazardous waste safely off-island to be remediated and dealt with in a manner that does not threaten the public and ecological health of our community.
But the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation already has enough money to take care of the problem. Wrangell residents just want to see more precautions taken. Representative Tammy Wilson of North Pole was reluctant to fund the extra payout.
So just wanting to know whether or not we're starting a precedence here where you have a safe site, you have money that you could utilize to be able to finish the project, but yet we're looking for unrestricted general funds instead.
The state cleaned up the Byford junkyard where Wrangell residents had dumped old cars for decades. A contractor treated the soil and contained it. The state's plan had been to put the soil in a rock pit on the island. But the public was outraged by this plan because the proposed site is about 1,000 feet away from a fishing stream and recreation area. Representative Lance Pruitt of Anchorage said now is too late to try to appease public concern.
If we've spent over $8 million and now we're addressing the community concerns, why weren't the community concerns addressed before we spent $8 million?
The state claims it wasn't legally obligated to involve the public, but it's clear the state wishes it would have. Jeff Rogers of the DEC says he understands why Wrangell is asking for another option.
When you've got a contaminated site in your backyard, it is a passionate local issue. Certainly we believe the site at Pat's Creek to be environmentally viable and sustainable. That doesn't mean that people want it in their backyard. There is a higher cost option, and the governor supports that higher cost option.
Senate and House Finance Committee meetings are continuing this week. The legislature plans to end its session and pass a budget next week. In Wrangell, I'm June Leffler.
Bristol Bay's Sacro herring fisheries are largely finished. In just under 2 weeks, seiners harvested their quotas in Togiak and Port Mahler. The gillnet harvest remains open for the one gillnet boat fishing the quota in the Togiak district. KDLG's Avery Lill has more.
The Togiak herring fishery closed to the purseine fleet on May 2nd. The quota for seiners was 16,800 tons, and they managed to take 16,500 tons. Warner Liu is the fleet manager for Icicle Seafoods. Liu also owns Deckhand Seafoods, which smokes, cans, and sells Togiak herring.
Well, the 2018 Togiak season was unusual in that it started way early, but it ran a full 11 days for the seine fishing. That was due mostly to the poor weather that never relented. It was windy, sloppy. Spotter pilots had a rough time flying. A lot of fish were caught with the sounders, not by the usual aerial spotting. It was tough fishing conditions.
The average roe recovery was reported at 11.4%. The overall size of the fish caught this year was 366 grams. Lou noted that these fish were smaller than normal.
The long-term average for a seine caught herring is 370 grams, and gillnets 400 or better. This year, the average was way smaller because of the high numbers of 5-, 6-, and 7-year-olds. So the market seemed to be more forgiving this year, probably due to the shortfall in Sitka, and the roe percent was just fine.
In April, the Sitka Sacro herring fishery closed 8,000 tons short of its quota. It's too early to know what price the herring will fetch at market or the base price fishermen will be paid, but Lou is optimistic that the low harvest in Sitka could increase the demand for Togiak herring. Another unusual factor in this year's Togiak herring fishery was colder than average water temperatures, which may have contributed to the herring staying in deeper waters further from shore. Alaska Department of Fish and Game Area Management biologist Tim Sands said that water temperatures usually rise above 3 degrees Celsius during the fishery.
That's when the spawning starts happening and the season really gets going. This year, they never got to 3 degrees, and the spawning didn't really happen like we normally see it. And I think that is part of the reason.
Despite the tough fishing conditions, Sands said the biomass was healthy. The Port Muller Sacro herring fishery opened briefly on Friday and Saturday. The 39-hour fishery harvested 1,000 tons of herring. Bob Murphy is an Alaska Department of Fish and Game biologist on the Alaska Peninsula.
This is what we were shooting for based on the biomass that we observed. The fleet, they were happy with the quality and didn't want to stick through the storm that was occurring. Folks thought it would be best just to start moving on to get home.
With about 17,500 tons of herring between Togiak and Port Muller, seining for herring in Bristol Bay is over for 2018. In Dillingham, I'm Avery Lill.
Coastal Villages Resource Fund commissioned a new report that the group says shows its federal fishery allocations are unfairly low. KNOM's Gabe Colombo has more.
CVRF is one of six nonprofit groups that manage the Community Development Quota, or CDQ, program. CDQ was set up in 1992 to bring money into cash-strapped Western Alaska communities by setting aside a portion of Bering Sea and Aleutians Islands fisheries for local commercial use. CVRF has long been advocating for more fish. Here's outreach manager Michelle Humphrey.
The allocations are not distributed currently based on any formula that focuses on economic need or population, and so the benefits delivered by the program are not being distributed fairly or equitably.
According to the report, the most impoverished communities are served by CVRF and the Norton Sound Economic Development Corporation, or NSEDC. These two represent nearly 70% of the total CDQ eligible population, but they receive only about 40% of the total CDQ quota. Sarah Marinin is an economist with the North Pacific Fishery Management Council, which oversees the CDQ program. She says when the program started in the 90s, each CDQ group submitted a business plan to the state, which then determined the allocations based on a variety of factors.
Demographic information about their communities, proposals for certain partnerships, harvesting vessels, essentially how they plan to use the allocation, how they'd set up their board of directors, if they're going to need additional state funds.
Marinin says political influence also probably played a role.
In terms of each group working to get the most that they can out of the allocations, anytime there's an allocation process within fisheries, there's going to be people who are lobbying hard for their group. That's part of the process when you've got the opportunity for public input in different places.
Any new changes would have to be made by amending a federal law called the Magnuson-Stevens Act. It requires a review of the quotas every 10 years, which started in 2012. No allocation changes have been made since 2006. Alaska's congressional delegation has said it wants consensus from all of the CDQ groups before pursuing changes. CVRF has been most vocal in its advocacy. NSEDC says it's not as worried about the allocations right now. Simon Kinneen is the corporation's vice president and quota acquisitions manager. Reading from a prepared statement, he says the amendments to the Magnuson-Stevens Act in 2006 did more than just lock in the quotas.
It also fostered coordination among the groups, provided stability for planning purposes, significantly reduced burdensome oversight, and allowed the groups to be more effective in our various member communities.
He says although larger allocations would be, quote, wonderful, NSCDC has still been able to do a lot of good with what it has. Reporting in Nome, I'm Gabe Colombo.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Raven Alaska. Raven now provides Alaskans with the day over, a 24-hour stop in any major hub along the way to a destination, including Anchorage, Kotzebue, and Bethel. More information at ravendayover.com. ACPE's Education Loan Refinance can save you money and give you just one bill for all your private, state, and federal loans. The Alaska Refinance Loan offers Alaska residents a 4.95% interest rate with no fees. You choose between a 5, 10, or 15-year plan. Go to acpe.alaska.gov/radio or call 1-800-441-2962. This message sponsored by Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education.
A hiker who's traversed many of the lower 48's toughest routes plans to take on the Brooks Range this summer. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, Carrot Quinn also plans to write about the experience to inspire wilderness protection and social change.
Carrot Quinn has hiked the Pacific Crest, Continental Divide, and other extended routes in the West. Quinn, who grew up in Anchorage, says she's always wanted to get back to Alaska for a long-distance trek.
I've been planning this trip across the Brooks Range for a couple years, and a friend and I are going to hike across the Alaskan Arctic from the Alaska-Yukon border to the Chukchi Sea. It's about 1,000 miles. We'll be on foot for the first 700, and the last 300 will be in inflatable kayaks.
Quinn has prepared extensively for the journey. She did a test hike in Gates of the Arctic National Park in 2016 and has consulted with Brooks Range Traverse veterans to design a unique route.
I had to create the route myself because too many people walking the same route can damage the tundra.
The trip will provide new material for Quinn's other passion, writing. She's authored a book about her experience on the Pacific Crest Trail and blogs extensively on a range of topics from the outdoors to social justice. Quinn plans to write throughout this summer's Brooks Range trek, in part to inspire support for Indigenous people working to protect the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge.
To try and shift resources and shift attention to these groups that don't get as much attention or are more invisible.
Quinn says she also hopes the trip can open up the wilderness experience to people not traditionally part of the outdoors community.
I'm a queer woman, and my hiking partner is a trans woman, which is really cool because in the outdoors community in general, there just are not very many trans people, and the queer community as well. There are not a lot of queer people in the outdoors. So visibility around that feels really good to me, and I'm super stoked about it.
Quinn says they plan to fly into their start point near the Alaska-Yukon border June 15th. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
As the school year comes to a close across the state, student activities culminate in a few big events. There's sports tournaments and final performances, awards ceremonies, and graduations. In Sitka, Monday night was the final concert for the fifth grade band as they showcased a year's worth of musical progress. KCAW's Emily Kwong has the story.
Balance is a key ingredient in the evolution of a fifth grade band. Students in the fall were just learning how to produce a sound and hear themselves over 82 others. Eight months later, they're learning how to play their own part while also listening for each other.
One and two, 21, those folks.
Starting to learn enough control that they could maybe back off a little bit and listen for someone else. Like in Pirates Parade, there's one part where everyone's playing except for the flutes, and then the flutes come in, and if everyone else doesn't back off a little bit, we will never hear the flutes.
But if they do, there will be that balance, which is exactly what happened Monday night when Pirates Parade debuted with a unique solo from Tanner Steinson screaming into his French horn. Each section performed a solo, and during instructor Mike Kernine's arrangement of Louie Louie, the fifth graders enthusiastically popped on a pair of sunglasses.
Dun, dun. It's a great pet band tune.
the laid-back look doesn't fully convey just how much work Brant Ferguson and her students have put into this performance. Some of that practice happens at home. Heather Ford's daughter, Bridget, practices the clarinet half an hour at a time.
It's usually 3 to 4 times a week that she'll do that.
That's really good for practicing.
Yeah, sometimes I think she does it more because she likes to hear the dog howl. She says the dog's singing with her.
And Bridget has come a long way too. In the beginning, she says, I was squeaking every other note.
My dog would howl and howl and howl, and I would keep playing and keep playing and keep playing.
But all that practicing eventually paid off. Brant Ferguson went so far as to prove that to her students. Midway through the concert, she plays them a recording of their very first song, Hot Cross Buns. Graders are turning pink at the sound of themselves at the beginning of the year. A few are curled into their laps trying to stifle laughter.
On that day, those fifth graders, these fifth graders, were very proud of themselves and should be because they were doing an awesome job for having played their instrument for 4 weeks. But boy, have we come a long way.
Some of these students will carry on with their musical craft in middle school. That's when Brant Ferguson says she got hooked on her instrument, the saxophone. And she wants her students to experience that love affair too, finding an instrument that fits them like a glove. She plays a sax for a class of fourth graders now. They're at the start of their band journey. And Brant Ferguson goes above and beyond for these students too, letting them slowly try out every instrument in the band to see what they like best.
Yeah, do it again. There you go, you got it figured out. Good for you, Haley.
And so, another cycle of fifth grade band begins, not with trumpet fanfare, but with a squeak. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Emily Kwong.
That is all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we are online at alaskapublic.org. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Rachel Waldholtz, Liz Ruskin, and Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage, June Leffler in Wrangell, Avery Lill in Dillingham, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Gabe Colombo in Nome, and Emily Kwong in Sitka. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Zachariah Hughes. Have a great night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline for 40 years and counting. The Alaska Native Village Corporation Association's 10th Annual Conference and Board Meeting is May 10th and 11th in Anchorage at the Egan Center. Learn about new developments and opportunities from Alaska's business leaders, network with Alaska Native Corporation executives, and hear from the nation's top figures in Native contracting and small business. Agenda and registration at anvca.biz. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Village Corporation Association. Join Alaska Public Media TV every week for Think Wednesday, featuring a dynamic lineup of programs exploring the thrilling world of nature, technology, and science. Think Wednesday explores the mysteries of our world and our universe, bringing the most exciting and inspiring stories that provide the answers that curious minds crave. Think Wednesday, every Wednesday beginning at 7 p.m. only on Alaska Public Media TV. This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.